Hello and welcome to Brain Trust Live's special Task Force Extravaganza.
Hey guys, I'm Brent.
I'm Lila, and you can find us on the web at www.braintrustlive.com.
That's right.
Welcome to our special midweek episode.
We promised you one, and listen, we've promised you things before. We don't always deliver. We know. You don't have to tell us, all right? Yeah. We get it. But now, look, we're in the middle of a pandemic. What else are we doing?
Also, we are eager to talk about these
things. I know, we are. Lila and I were talking earlier today, and I was like, oh no, I have therapy tonight. I've been doing therapy on Zoom. And she was like, well, are you working, and do you have to commute anywhere? And I was like, great point.
Yeah. He had time to do that before therapy, after therapy, any of the other times of the day. And I was eager to do this because I have been taking my daily walk and using it to just gripe about the healthcare task
force. Yeah, we've been getting ourselves worked up about this.
So. Right. So I'm eager to use this as an opportunity to exercise some of my, I won't say rage, thoughts
about the healthcare task force. This is going to be your therapy today.
That's right. So if you don't recall from past rants, the Biden campaign put together six task forces that were supposed to bring in people from the Sanders coalition and the Biden coalition and the moderate people's coalition.
In a 5-3 setting.
In a 5-3 setting, in which they would discuss six topics: climate change or the environment, criminal justice, the economy, education, healthcare, and immigration.
Yeah.
And they just this week released an 110-page report about their findings and recommendations.
Too long.
It's much too long.
By the way.
Also, it's a lot of bloviating, because what it is they all write like an 8-page thing, like expounding about how glorious the Democrats are, and then they write like a brief checklist about their thoughts, basically.
Right.
So the whole thing is just designed to make Democrats feel like Democrats are glorious, forward-thinking.
Right. We're really doing it out
here. Bloviators. That's right. But in fact, we're not always doing it. And one thing I think that is not in the document is what's not in the document. You know, you can read the document and think, this all sounds like brilliant ideas that we should definitely do. And a lot of them are things that are better than not doing them.
Right.
But what we're here to bring you is some perspective on what could have been in the document, what's left out of the document, and why the document came out the way that it did. And there were, so of the six committees, they all worked a little differently. Some of them got more achieved from the progressive perspective, or achieved more from the progressive perspective than others. Some of them achieved next to nothing from a progressive perspective. We're going to tell you all about that.
Yeah. And look, are all of these better than Biden's previous platforms? I mean, maybe, because he didn't really have platforms on a lot of these things,
That's
which
right.
I think on some level the left was blessed by that. You know, I think part of the reason why there weren't task forces, besides the fact that Hillary Clinton didn't want to hear them, part of the reason why she didn't want to hear them is because she thought that she had invented every good idea that had ever been invented herself personally over time. So she didn't need the help of task forces. On some level, this is just very self-serving for Joe Biden, because he didn't know what he thought about any of this stuff. Except the things that he did know that he knew, which were the wrong things, which he really stuck to his guns on.
That's right.
I don't know if that made sense. But anyway.
It made sense to me.
Okay,
and who else are you doing this for if not me?
Right. Carla, did that make sense? Text me later.
That's, we'll get a group email about that.
Yeah.
But in any case, I think we all went in knowing that our progressive expectations would not be met in a lot of these cases. What I think is sort of bizarre about the outcome is just that it seems like it took a lot of work from the Sanders coalition to prove some pretty obvious needs to the Biden coalition. The concessions that they're framing as concessions are like things that everyone should know and agree are good ideas.
Well, that has been the thing that I have been struggling with here, because I always knew that we probably weren't going to talk Biden into getting Medicare for all. I mean, if he was willing to listen, then maybe we would have talked him into it. I would just contend that he had no interest in listening to it. But I think the whole idea of the Sanders movement over time that sort of has really become highlighted recently, both during the coronavirus and also during all of the racial justice, you know, issues that this country is going through and just like the general upheaval, is that so many people, even sort of outside of that movement, I think have sort of acknowledged that it was that movement who probably knew that some of these things already existed. Like, the Sanders campaign already knew we had a healthcare crisis. They already knew that we had a climate crisis. They already knew that we had an economic crisis and a, you know, a racial justice crisis. And in the midst of where we are now, all of those things have sort of been, like, brought out into the light. So now would have been the time that you could have literally just copied and pasted their entire platform.
That's right.
And had all of the right answers. They could have skipped all of the pain and torture of having so many Zoom meetings.
That's right.
And just said, hey, email me your platform on all six of these things.
If there's one thing that we know, it's that Zoom meetings are incredibly boring and complicated to conduct. And these are people that had to conduct multiple Zoom meetings, presumably, to write out a long-winded document that stated a position that they already had in the Biden coalition about six different areas of interest.
Right.
And that seems like it was a waste of everyone's time.
Right. But it really seems like this lengthy process to, like, push for some sort of, like, weird middle ground, like, is only just because of, like, what, like, Biden's pride on not changing a position on something? Like, I literally don't understand, like, what all of this... I'm having trouble grasping why we're here.
I can tell you exactly why we're here. So, good news. great. We're here because the Biden coalition did not want to move on any of these issues, but they did want there to be the perception that they were listening because they knew that the way that he won the primary was frustrating to progressives and that he was somebody who did not have really any enthusiasm behind him at all.
Right.
And so they were looking for a way to co-opt the enthusiasm of the Sanders coalition, which is, if nothing else, a lot of really enthusiastic young people who are willing to spend the next, you know, 5 months working 18 hours a day to get Bernie Sanders something.
Totally.
So
I mean, I think
they were looking for a way to seem like we were in the conversation without inviting us into the conversation.
It was a shrewd move.
Yeah.
Maybe not as shrewd as I think they thought it was, but...
It would have been a shrewd move in 1994. In 1994, this would have been the height of shrewd moves.
Right.
I think we are, in our second round of Sanders losing, we're a little bit hip to their... strategies at the moment.
Yeah.
And so it's not as, I don't think co-opting the left is as easy as it once was. I think, you know, we all recognize the, you know, external threat being Donald Trump. It's not that people on the left are too stupid to realize what the choice is here.
Yeah.
I think the issue is, though, that the strategies by which you would make it seem like we had unified as a party are going to be much harder to pull on people the second time around because we already feel like we sold our soul to the devil once and didn't get what we were looking for. And now we're basically being asked to sign up for a proven losing strategy. And that is pretty disheartening. And it's not something that you want to do as someone who was once excited about ideas.
Right.
And so I think this is a good year to get people excited about being against Donald Trump, but it's going to be a difficult year to co-opt the left the way that they normally would have, the way that the Clinton movement tried to.
Yeah. No, I think you're right. And I think the other thing that was interesting about this, and you kind of hit on this there when you were talking about, you know, we basically just like sort of signed up to sign on to, you know, these policy ideas that they had already had. And I think that, you know, we pushed as far as we could in some instances, but I do think that that's the other thing that I think has like annoyed me about these, especially since we've now see what is in them. And look, some of them are not the worst. But I think that in a few instances that we'll talk about, these were things that, you know, the Biden camp had already litigated all of these issues, whether it had been in the primaries against his opponents or amongst themselves. And it was obvious that they had no interest in hearing some of these things. In the sense that, like, had someone from the Sanders camp showed up and said, 2 + 2 = 4... if they had previously decided before these task forces that 2 + 2 = 7, then they were not going to hear from the Sanders campaign about 2 + 2 = 4.
Right.
Even though that was...
They weren't going to ban fracking, even though that's wildly popular.
Right, exactly. They had decided...
decriminalize marijuana, even though that's entire... Right. You know, that, or legalize marijuana, even though that's incredibly popular.
Right.
They weren't going to come out against qualified immunity, even though that's incredibly popular. Like, these are all things that their voters actually want.
Right. So it seems like some of these discussions were perhaps not entered into in good faith.
Correct. And it seems like some of the Sanders Coalition knows that.
There was somebody...
an anonymous member of the healthcare task force. And I'm going to tell you one of three people that it was, because there were only three Sanders people on the healthcare task force. It was either Pramila Jayapal, Abdul El Sayed, or I think Mary Kay Henry was the third. She's the president of SEIU, was the third Sanders appointee. So it was one of those three.
Right. But they said, I recognize that this issue was very clearly litigated in the primary, and it was going to be hard for us to push beyond the framework that they had come up or that they had come to with this. So they had already decided on their cockamamie.
Right. They were not in favor of Medicare for All.
Right.
It was too late.
So, like, the idea that you could have three people on a task force who all were, you know, ardent supporters of Medicare for All could move the needle on this was a laughable idea. And I think that we all probably knew that, and they probably knew it to a certain degree. But, like, I think the point is, why bother? if everybody knows where you're going to end up at the end of this, then it's like...
Why they bothered also, because I think one thing that they did get out of this, which was its actual intention from the Biden perspective, was a bunch of really powerful Sanders mouthpieces endorsed Biden the day these came out, or otherwise, because they are now invested in the platform, because the platform is now something that they have theoretically come up with together with his people, have now sort of pledged support to him in stronger language than I think they could have otherwise used. I think that was the case. You know, I got into a back and forth with Abdul El Sayed on Twitter this week, which,
very
guys,
exciting.
Follow me on Twitter, but also no one does. So that was a surprise. But it was because I suggested that I wasn't sort of even meaning this to be a swipe at him, because I know what went on here. But just that it was heartbreaking to watch him and then Adie Barkin, who's another big Medicare for All activist, come out in favor of Biden in these strong terms when I knew that they had basically been sideswiped by the campaign, policy-wise. So as much as we know that someone like Abdul El Sayed, who was someone who ran for governor in Michigan, that's probably where you know his name from, but is somebody who's very active in the Medicare for All discussion, and a big, you know, was a Sanders Coalition member. Somebody like him would have obviously been able to see the difference between Joe Biden and Donald Trump. That's not really the question, but would not have endorsed his healthcare platform the way that he had to as somebody who now kind of had an investment in it.
Right.
And I think he was feeling sensitive about it because he was very defensive on Twitter, which is what I picked up on. And and he was really defensive because he responded to a comment from a nobody, i.e. me, about it. But I think it put a lot of the Sanders coalition members in that position.
Yeah.
Which was its intention.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the task force.
Yeah, let's dig in. We'll do climate first.
Climate first, because that was the one where I think they got the most accomplished from a progressive perspective. And that is probably because the co-chair from the Sanders Coalition was AOC.
Right.
And
she should have co-chaired all of these.
She should have co-chaired every... Right. She should be on the co-chair of every task force.
She probably just scared John Kerry into signing off on whatever she wanted.
I remember when these task force announcements were made, and I was like, that is sneaky, because he's somebody... Like, they basically paired her with the person with the most gravitas of any of the other task force co-chairs.
She did not give one solitary shit about that.
Yeah, no.
They might have gotten along famously, actually.
I feel like... The thing that I think is valuable about her is she's a really good communicator, and that is something that she brings to the table, even if the person she's communicating to is a stodgy old person who, like, wants to think what he thinks. And John Kerry, by the way, is not someone that I, like, detest. I think he's someone who is a – or he's not in the Senate anymore.
He showed up good intentions.
He was a thoughtful senator. He had good intentions. He was a good Secretary of State. I don't think that he's – somebody who necessarily came in to be impossible.
Right.
But also, this was an area where they had a lot of ground to make up, because Biden's climate plans were god-awful.
Oh, yeah. It was consistently got the lowest grades from any of the environmental organizations of any of the 2020 candidates that were running for president.
Exactly. It
was notably bad.
Now, there were some interesting additions to this committee that were designed to slow progress, I would argue. Like, Connor Lamb is not who I would put on a climate change committee. He comes from a Rust Belt district.
Right.
He's very conservative.
He's the one who was fighting against the fracking ban. Being from Pennsylvania. That was Connor Lamb's doing.
And then Varshini Prakash, who's the co-founder of the Sunrise Movement, executive director, was also... I mean, this was like a pretty powerhouse Sanders crew, because I think, like... The Sunrise Movement is also, like, I think one of the things that's really brilliant about them is they are, like, really good communicators on this issue, and they are also, like, just sort of merciless.
Right.
And they are the, I think that they had given Biden an F on his climate platform before, so, like, they were not trying to fuck around.
Right.
But a lot of the people on this committee were people that have sort of, like, vaguely worked in, like, sustainability policy and things like that, but in, like, the most sort of, like, corporate-y or corporate adjacent of settings.
Yeah.
And so I think one thing that's really striking about the language in this section is it is, like, really clear about how environmental justice relates to other issues of inequality.
Yep.
And that is, I think, not something that Biden was talking about very convincingly before this, or was acknowledging was a thing before this. So I think that you can see the handprints of the fingerprints of the Sanders coalition appointees all over that. But there is a notable absence of a fracking ban.
Yep.
So that seems like an obvious thing that they maybe could have done and didn't. And I don't know why these corporate Dems are so pro-fracking. Remember when Hillary Clinton just couldn't not love fracking?
I know.
She was repeatedly asked, and it was such an easy one, because it's like, that's one very sort of narrow aspect of the energy, you know, world that also has, like, huge environmental consequences, very specifically in rural regions.
Yeah.
And because of that, in states like Pennsylvania, where you really need votes.
Yeah.
And I don't, like, it's so crazy to me that remains something they are, like, so steadfast on.
I know. It's weird. And it also, you know, one of the things that, for as many good things as there are in this, the one thing that it sort of, like, doesn't really do, and this sort of ties in with the fracking ban, is that, you know, they're pushing to get to, you know, renewables, and I think, like, a net zero carbon emissions by, like, 2050, and I think they moved up sort of some other target to 2035 from 2050. So that was, like, the big headline out of this. I think that they had moved some of the deadlines like by quite a bit.
Eliminating carbon pollution from power plants.
But on the other hand of this, and I guess probably you leave it out politically, because this is where it gets political and hard to sort of navigate. And Hillary Clinton ran up against this in 2016 when she talked about, you know, putting coal workers out of jobs, which she specifically said, which was, you know, clearly not the way to go in some of these places. But you still have to, in addition to sort of, like, pushing for renewables, you still have to have a plan to phase out fossil fuels. You can't just sort of, like, push all the renewables and then just expect that fossil fuels will go away just because of the marketplace. We've tried marketplace ideas for
those have for the not last, been successful,
since, like, the
80s
for this, or, you know, 90s anyway, and that doesn't work. So I think that the fracking ban ties into that, and that's one of the things that concerns me here. There's so much good stuff in this, but it's just sort of like, can you really push all of this appropriately if you're not going to also be like, no, we are not going to do this any longer?
Yeah. No, I think it's like, you know, there's a lot of language that echoes some of the language in the Green New Deal, where they talk a lot about investing in sectors where they're going to create jobs and where this is going to be a way to sort of overcome the economic slump that the pandemic has created. And it lays out a lot of different ways that they can provide jobs and job training. And, you know, obviously it does all the things that are, like, you know, sort of signally things like rejoin the Paris Climate Agreement and, like, believe in science or whatever. But I think the sort of centerpiece, aside from the goal, you know, moving up some of our goals, environmental goals, is this jobs program that it proposes.
Especially now.
Well, and a lot of these propose big jobs programs, by the way. Like, that's the healthcare one also proposes hiring. Like, a lot of them are like, what are we going to do with everyone now that everyone's sitting at home and not able to leave their houses? And, you know, that's a way for Biden, if nothing else, someone that is pro-union and unions love.
So it
goes on and on about making sure people can join unions. It doesn't specify in any way how they are going to provide these union benefits to people. It says that the jobs that are created should be union jobs, and it's like, okay, well, what are you going to do to make them union jobs?
Right, I know.
Like, what the kind of plan is that?
I know. I will say that and I like that about this and about some of the other platforms, and I think it's a good way for him to go, especially because I think that, you know, he's obviously not a populist, but if he can at least sort of, like, play one on TV, then I think that's going to go a long way in this election. I saw, you know, he's been giving sort of like these, I think he's got four or five scheduled speeches to give, and he's like going around in various different places. And so far, all of them have been in the Rust Belt. He was in, I think he gave this one from Pennsylvania the other day, but he rolled out this climate plan, basically. And it sounded like it just sounded like a jobs plan. It didn't even sound like a climate plan. It sounded like a jobs
Which
plan.
Which is and how that, they should have been pitching climate.
I mean, hello. This whole They've time. Had this like, blueprint for quite a long time. You right? know, I mean, like Van Jones wrote the Green Collar Economy, well, like 20 years ago.
I have
ago.
Never I mean, understood like, why moderate Democrats have not, like, they have gone out of their way to make the progressive climate change action sound like it's like radical craziness when it's always been a jobs program. The progressive climate plan has always just been a jobs program. It's
right, they're
always
calling been about it. They're calling it a Green New Deal for a reason.
Exactly. Like that language was designed to make you think it was about jobs because it is. Yeah. And the idea that that's controversial, like you can argue about where those investments should be made in terms of jobs.
Yeah.
But like the idea that the center left has never embraced the language of job creation in climate the way that the far left has and has been trying to distance themselves from that language has always been kind of mind-boggling to me.
Yeah.
Because I feel like one thing everyone loves is jobs.
Yeah. Oh, totally.
It's, you know, and so they talk about all the stuff that you would talk about where they're going to get rid of greenhouse gas emissions and eliminate carbon pollution and expand solar and wind energy.
Yeah.
They're going to put solar panels on all of our roofs and they're going to make it so that everyone retrofits their buildings and
yeah,
so
there's some things
building
that there's
buildings
cons-
with
yeah,
emissions
sorry.
And whatnot. No, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, there's some things about, well, that you made me think of this because there's some things about what you were just talking about in terms of like buildings and things like that that concern me a little bit, just language.
Yeah.
Wise
yes.
in here, you know, within 5 years, we're going to incentivize private sector investment to retrofit 4 million buildings, which to me sounds like a fucking tax cut that they don't
That's
need.
A tax cut
Just
for
tell them they,
wealthy people.
Tell them they have to, is what you do.
Yeah.
Like,
right. Make
demand
a policy that.
That
you, to have a building,
right. don't,
have to.
Don't give a
retrofit.
Corporation anything for putting a solar panel on their roof. I mean,
no.
No. And, you know,
Give
also
them
sort
the
of like
the joy of not paying as much for electricity.
Right. And encourage states
Done.
And cities to adopt energy efficient building codes. I can pretty much point to on a map which ones will do that and won't do that.
Right. We already know and they don't need encouragement.
With
from
encouragement
the federal
or
government.
Without encouragement. Right.
Right.
So,
right.
I mean, look, this is just a blueprint. I get that. And it's better than his old F-minus rated plan from
right.
the Sunrise Movement. But it's not. It's not there yet.
Well, let me tell you what the real plan is here. I know what the plan is. It's deep into this document. And the plan is to make it so that states like California can set their own standards. That's what this whole document to me
Sure.
means almost nothing except for that. Because California setting its own clean air standards actually does have an impact on the market in
Totally
a way
does.
That trickles down to the rest of the country.
Well, and that's one of
the
things.
The fact
that
the Trump administration
Yeah.
doesn't want to let us do that
Right.
is problematic because that was one way to make sure that car emission standards were being enforced nationwide.
Totally.
Was to make it so that the biggest market in the country, you know,
yeah.
you couldn't sell cars with poor emissions.
Right.
The
and Trump knew
the
that, which is why he overturned it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So somewhat, like, to me, in reading all of these lists, this wish list of things that all are like, within 5 years, we'll encourage people to do a thing that maybe they'll do, we don't know. I feel like the thing that this really means to me, or the sort of most meaningful, aside from the language that just forces the Biden people to like reaffirm that this is an issue of inequality. The environmental issues are issues of inequality. There's a lot of language that I can tell you exactly where it came from in this document that is about how environmental racism affects people, is about how differing environmental standards affect different communities, and how the federal government has a responsibility to address those concerns and to consider those concerns
yeah.
while they're coming up with federal policy. I would say that I am. It's unfortunate that that feels to me like something that really does need to be stated by the Biden coalition, because
right.
I don't necessarily believe it was a focus of theirs before this. And so I think that there is value in making sure that's in this document.
Yes.
But it's not policy. It's just like, here's a thing we should do to be nice and that we should have already
I know.
Known.
I know.
To me, the most meaningful thing that they could easily do without using any political capital is just let states set their own policy in a way that I think there should be federal policy that protects states from making really dumb decisions, but if states want to have even stricter policies than what the federal government is promoting, they should let states do that. And that is a way that they can have their hands-off approach while still potentially having good things happen, which is, you know, unfortunate that that's where I feel the most optimistic about the chances of any of this happening. But here we are. You know, right. We live in the world. Yeah. So, you know, they're going to transition all the public cars in the world to, you know, to zero emission alternatives. And so your school buses or whatnot will be American made zero emission alternatives. And they're going to put charging stations in and then theoretically invest in public transit, although they don't really specify how or why.
Yeah.
For the most part, aside from, you know, upgrading our power grid and making sure that people in rural areas have power, which is a thing that we don't do very well here. There's a lot of this is sort of like the stuff that you would say before you decided not to do anything, because most of it is just like encouraging other people to do things.
Yeah.
But with that said, I think the language in this is definitely the strongest of all of the task forces, and it's certainly the most sort of specific about how the issue manifests itself as other kinds of injustice.
Yeah.
So to me, that is at least something to make them think about, you know?
I mean, seriously.
I mean, literally, yeah. That's, you know.
Yeah.
It's a thing. It's a thing. Let's move on to healthcare. Guys, I've been raging a lot about this.
I know. I'm surprised you didn't just throw this one at the top. Just
I was going to, but I wanted to feel optimistic, and the environmental one was the only one where we had any, where they like adopted anything that was like, it was like the area where he had the most to grow and actually grew the most. He has a long way to go on healthcare, but he hasn't chosen to take that route.
Right. He already had a firm stance.
Right. So in this, they include a plan for crisis coverage, which is basically like protections that should be permanent anyway, that for some reason should only qualify, should only be the case during the crisis, that have to do with who automatically can get coverage, and also the fact that they are willing to pay for people's COBRA, which to me, every time I read that in any sort of proposal from Democrats or conservatives or insects or anyone, it's like so rage-inducing. Because COBRA is so much more expensive than us covering these people publicly. It is so much worse coverage for the totally. Cost. It is unconscionable to me that we would continue to insist that an employer-based healthcare model is in any way a thing to try, given that 5.4 million Americans lost their health coverage in the last few months, which we just learned last week as well. And to face those numbers and release this platform in the same week is just, like, to me, a mind-boggling problem. And like I said, listen.
So you're going to pay the private insurance bills for 5.4 million people.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or, and then also that means that people who weren't insured before this but are now also uninsured because they lost their jobs and continue to be uninsured have nothing to do. They can just hang out and die, I guess. I don't know. I was excited about this panel only because two people that I really trust were on it. Pramila Jayapal, who is my healthcare policy spirit animal, because we both came out against the public option the same month. Me first, by the way, but whatever. Abdullah Saeed, I think, is a great advocate for healthcare.
Yeah.
And I was excited that he was on this. I feel ambivalent about almost everyone else that was on. I mean, Mary Kay Henry is fine. Like, I think SEIU does really great work on healthcare advocacy. And also, that's a union that reps a bunch of healthcare workers. So, like, they know what they're talking about. The rest of these, the people that the Biden administration, or the administration, the Biden coalition put on here is, like, people that, like, Vivek Murthy is, like, writing books about how to be happy. Like, he's he was the Surgeon General, but, I don't know what he's doing other than telling us how to be happy at the moment. And I feel like a lot of these other people have just been government functionaries.
That's exactly on
healthcare, which, and healthcare policy has not been working right. So, like, I don't trust that that's necessarily something that I
am. Just because you know a lot about our current system doesn't mean you know a lot about anything.
Right, exactly. So, instead of endorsing Medicare for All, The task force advocated for a public option that would be offered to all Americans on a sliding scale according to income and automatically provided to low-income people as a free opt-out situation instead of an opt-in situation, but only during the emergency.
Right. That's so ridiculous. So you're going to throw a bunch of people onto healthcare during an emergency.
Once unemployment's down, we're just going to kick them right off.
And then arbitrarily decide that the emergency is over and then like kick them off of the plan that they have or make them start paying for it.
And this is, I think, one thing where I really question whether Democrats and I have the same priorities, because this is something that was elucidated to me by the by that Fox News town hall from 2016 that I always go on about, where Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders were both asked about their position on abortion. And Hillary Clinton said that she might be in favor of some late-term abortion bans, and Bernie Sanders was like, "It's not my business." And it occurred to me during that, not debate, town hall, that Hillary Clinton was actually engaging in the conversation about where the line is, assuming that the government had a role in deciding whether a woman could have had the right to choose. And that the question was just, where's the line? And to her, the line is like almost, it's almost not our business, but it is in these certain cases. And Bernie Sanders was basically saying, this is not a role for government. And I think this is sort of the opposite situation, where healthcare is a role for government. Like providing health coverage to every person is a role for government. And they are arguing about where it isn't their role, instead of agreeing that it is their role and trying to figure out how to make it work as their role. This is like the idea of allowing Americans an opt-out situation during an emergency, or anytime, frankly, is so patently absurd because it creates even more instability for people that, and like, remember, when you lose your healthcare, even if you go to different healthcare, you change doctors, your network changes, you don't know where you can go during an emergency because some hospitals take your insurance and some don't. Yeah. Like, these are issues that affect everything about your quality of life, and the idea that the government is trying to decide where their role is, as opposed to being like, it's our role, let's just do it, is so insane to me. And it's also insane to Pramila Jayapal, which is why I was surprised to see that she was on this committee, because both her and I have detailed why the public option plan is so flawed.
Right.
Only one of us was on this panel, but both of us have talked about it.
I'm sure she explained it to them, and I'm sure that they just didn't listen.
There were some even more offensive things about the way that they frame this, too, because hilariously, they say that the public option should include the choice of a no-deductible plan, meaning that you can buy a Medicare plan that has no deductible as one of the options in this public system that they're going to offer you access to. But what does that mean? That means that the Biden plan, which initially would have a $1,000 deductible, keep in mind that most Americans can't come up with, you know, $400 in an emergency.
Right. People aren't paying their rent right now, by the way.
People aren't paying their rent right now, but the Biden plan...
Like a third of people didn't pay their rent or
within a $1,000 deductible could also be one of the plans that's offered, meaning that they can say that for $700 a month, you can have the plan with no deductible in Medicare, or for an affordable $250, you can have a deductible of $60 billion. And then they can still say that they're including the choice of a no-deductible plan. That doesn't actually provide most people with a choice, though.
Yeah.
You can claim you're releasing affordable plans and then also be releasing unaffordable plans. And if one of those has no deductible, whether it's the affordable one or not, you're not providing any service to anyone. It just, this is like a sleight of hand that I can't, like, again, I get where they started from. They started from a man who wants to make sure you pay and doesn't believe that it is the state's responsibility to provide for the health care of their citizens. Correct. So, like, I get that this is a tough position to be in as someone who believes in Medicare for all, but come fucking on.
I know.
And then they're going to increase the subsidy, which is good because it's currently like basically a fake subsidy.
Yeah.
But subsidies, this is another thing that I want to address, which is that subsidies are subsidizing private businesses that are providing you insurance right now, or even nonprofit businesses that are providing you insurance like Blue Shield. These are subsidies that the federal government is paying to companies. It is not paying them to your doctors. It is not paying them to the hospitals that provide you care or the facilities that provide you care. It is paying them to a private insurer who is then deciding what you can and can't be covered for.
Yeah.
So when they say they're going to increase the subsidy, what they mean is that they're going to increase the amount of money the federal government, i.e. us, is going to pay to a bunch of corporations that are acting as middlemen in a system that we have already devised a way to provide care through. Like, we already have a public way to provide this care. So there's no reason for these middlemen, and yet your tax dollars are going to go to them. And likely the subsidies are still not going to be adequate for people living in high-cost areas. They're currently not. you know, if you make $49,000 a year right now in New York City, like, you can't qualify for a subsidy, but you also can't afford a one-bedroom apartment.
Right. That's
like not just can't afford, no, but like your entire salary couldn't pay for a one-bedroom apartment.
Right.
So we're talking about subsidies that currently cap out at rates that are very reasonable in some rural parts of the country, but are not even in the ballpark of real things in most of in the parts of the country that most people live, because 70% of people live in cities.
Right.
So we're talking about a system where one number is likely going to apply to every American, and that means that people in large cities are going to be screwed no matter what, because there is no way this subsidy is going to be applied in a way that is fair to people in large cities facing huge costs of living.
Yep.
And so, in any case, this adds some things to the Biden plan. You know, it requires that some medications for chronic illness be offered without out-of-pocket cost, or
right,
low out-of-pocket
I think it allows
they're
for,
looking specifically at things like diabetes, you know, insulin and stuff.
Yeah,
like
exactly.
That
and I think it allows Medicare to negotiate prices.
Right.
Also.
Which is always that's a talking point of the Sanders coalition, always.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, it's it provides I think for pandemic related issues, what is an important stopgap in the system that we don't currently have, which is that, you know, right now your insurance is required to cover 100% of the cost of your COVID-19 care, but a lot of people are going for COVID-19 care and getting treatment for ancillary conditions at the same time, and their insurance is not willing to cover those costs.
Yeah.
And so they're still going home with huge medical bills.
Well, and I mean, we've seen this. I mean, you've seen all of these different stories about, you know, man goes home with $3 million medical bill after, you know, COVID-19. It's like you see one of those every single day of, you know, some insane bill that somebody's getting from having this.
Exactly. So the other thing that is patently offensive about this plan is that it lowers the Medicare age to 60.
Right.
Like,
and
just go home.
And he mentioned that a while ago as like an olive branch, and we railed about that on this podcast before.
Olive branch.
Right. I had forgotten until recently that Hillary Clinton was going to lower it to 55. I mean, I think you would still have had to have like paid into it at 55, but like, or like purchased it from, but like lowering it 5 years is not like a thing that anybody cares about. Certainly not the Sanders.
No,
camp.
I think, well, he's stuck in 1994 when they were talking about raising it. And so to him, the idea of lowering it at all is like probably pretty revolutionary.
Right. He probably offered raising it at some point from the Senate floor, talked about
certainly,
it.
Certainly. Certainly. He probably gave an impassioned speech about how important it was at some point.
Right. To
I also want to point out that in lowering the age, or just admitting that Medicare is an idea, Joe Biden understands how public coverage works and why it's a good idea.
Yeah, he wants to put more people on
it. He's saying that more people deserve it.
Right, he wants to expand Medicaid also.
Yeah.
That's in here.
He wants,
you know?
The fact is that he just doesn't want to expand it beyond his own generation.
Right.
So what he's saying right now is like, I get it. More people need public care because people are in a tough situation in America.
Right.
The thing is, I just can't empathize with anyone who's not of my specific
just
generation.
Just not everyone.
Just not everyone.
Yeah.
You guys should work for it. We, obviously not. You know, like, the idea that he wants to expand it at all indicates that he understands why socialized care works.
Right.
Because it works for old people.
Yeah.
And he understands, by lowering it to 60, he understands why it works to people who are not yet retired, which is everyone who is not 65 and over.
Yeah.
So he's saying that there is a group of people who are currently employed in the current economy who would benefit from having access to a public single-payer system.
Yeah.
Just not anyone that's not of my specific generation. Like, fuck all the way off.
Yeah.
And
one of the things that, and you and I were talking about this prior to when we actually started recording, because we were sort of, you know, railing about this like we do. This is what we talk about, by the way, when we're not recording.
Yeah,
we're like permanently recording a podcast.
One of Brent's, or he's a mutual friend of ours, but he's a really good friend of Brent's, once asked us, if we talk about relationships, and we both looked at him like he was the most insane person that we had ever seen. And we were like, no, because we had just been like railing at him for like 30 minutes about some issue that had like Medicare or something like that. And he was like, don't you guys like talk about your feelings? And we were like, no.
No, we don't.
Talk about policy.
Yeah. But we were talking about, you know, because there's some things in here like, you know, doubles the funding for qualified healthcare centers. It increases funding to the Indian Health Service, which I didn't know was a thing. Rural healthcare systems, National Health Service Corps. I don't know what that is either. It is going to extend the Affordable Care Act coverage to DACA recipients, which is great. But that's, you know, just more people that they're having to sort of like fund specifically. Medicare, Medicaid, and the Children's Health Insurance Program eligibility. They have gone to read all of these things just sort of like in concession like that. You know, I know our system is stupid, but I think when you sort of look at it, and I'm sure that's only, you know, 1/10 of, probably 1/100 of the specific programs that we have that are like attempting to fill gaps that we have in our system right now. But we know that we're still going to be left with gaps after all of this. Yeah. What's so crazy, you know, and you can also think about
a like piecemeal funding, approach guarantees
funding,
that
funding COBRA also, you know, which we talked about already. There are all of these specific things to not even get close to ensuring everyone that they have to fund, that it makes the system seem even more insane because there is a system. There's one system that you could just fund.
That's right.
You could just
be pretty simple.
You could just fund Medicare for All, which is why it's been dubbed Medicare for All. Like, you wouldn't have to fund the Indian Health Service. You wouldn't have to extend the Affordable Care Act to DACA recipients because they would be living in America and then they would just have health care. So
you wouldn't have to specifically make sure that children have health coverage with CHIP because you wouldn't be in a system where children could have no health coverage.
Right, exactly.
So the idea that we live in a system where a child could have no health coverage and that was a gap we had to fill is
thinking about all of these things, you know, individually sort of like and in the aggregate as to where they even get you when you fund all of them individually anyway and you're still left with, you know, what do we have, like, well, we know 5 million people just lost their insurance, but what, didn't we have like 10 million people that were either...
Oh, 30 million.
Well, I think uninsured and then more that are underinsured, obviously. But more people are going to be
underinsured. 80 million people underinsured. 60 million people underinsured. Okay. 30 million people uninsured.
Uninsured.
And the best case scenario under a public option plan is that 10 million people remain uninsured.
That's probably where I got that number. Yeah. Yes. So
I think about that a lot.
The idea that
his best case scenario plan
leaves
10 million people without health coverage.
Right, and you've decided
10 million people.
Right.
That's more people than live in Denmark.
Right.
Continue.
Yeah. No, that's it. I was just, my point was that, like, to think about all of these specific things that you would have to fund when you literally have the right answer that you could just fund.
Yeah.
It sort of boggles the mind.
Having to do all this piecemeal funding, it stops being so cost effective at a certain point because we're having to make up for gaps that shouldn't exist.
Totally.
We're having to overcome obstacles that shouldn't exist in the first place to care.
Yeah.
You know, the thing that we should be arguing about is where do we invest public funds to provide, to make sure there are clinics and facilities for people to go to? That's what usually you argue about in a civilized country when it comes to figuring out how to address inequality in the healthcare system. You argue, like, do rural healthcare systems or do urban healthcare systems have enough funding for the number of people they serve and the areas that they serve? You don't argue about whether children have any access to health insurance at all.
Right.
Like, that's bananas. And then another point before we move on. They spent a lot of time in this section blaming Republicans for things failing.
Oh, yeah.
For the Affordable Care Act failing. Because you know how important it is to Joe Biden that we continue to talk forever about the Affordable Care Act and we can never improve it. We just have to keep it. like, his idea of improving it is just, like, continuing to enforce it as is. But I just want to point out that I can't stand it when Democrats go on and on and on about blaming all the Republicans for all the things that failed in the healthcare system without acknowledging that it was a Democrat who dealt the death blow to the public option.
Yeah.
It was Democrats that gutted the Affordable Care Act. Hashtag never forget Ben Nelson.
Uh-huh.
Hashtag remember your history on healthcare. That's not a good hashtag. But I mean, like, this is not a problem of just Republicans. We had majorities in every chamber when we passed this law, and it was Democrats that kept it from being the policy that Joe Biden wants it to be. So I don't want to hear about, get your own people in line, friend. Like, I don't want to hear about the Republicans being such horrible, terrible people. They're horrible, terrible people. We did it. We know. Whatever.
Right.
But I don't want to hear about that when you can't get your own people through the door on something like this. We are in a country where the center left, and this is something I've been tweeting about this a lot. So if you do follow me on Twitter, you'll find that I've been tweeting about it a lot. But I've never understood why the center left position on healthcare is not single payer with an additional option to buy in additional coverage, like a Medicare Part D system. That's where the center left should be. The center left should be advocating that we have a Medicare for all system, but that special rich people get to buy special coverage.
Right, if you want a Cadillac plan, then you can
exactly
have it.
Yep. That's a plan where individual corporations can still buy special things and use it as a carrot. That's a plan where corporations can still make money selling you unnecessary insurance that you don't need. Yep. That's a plan where you can still screw over poor people. But it's a plan where at least everyone's basic needs are taken care of and rich people still get to feel special, which is all that they really want. So I don't understand why we're coming down in favor of what is a patently conservative idea, the idea that the private market should be the should be sort of an equal participant in the healthcare marketplace with the government. The public option plan is a Heritage Foundation plan. It is a plan that was first instituted by a Republican governor. It is not a center-left position inherently. It is a center-right position, the right position being that no one should have anything, and the far-left position being that there should be no room for private companies in covering people's health care. I just don't understand why we're arguing about a center-right position on the left. Yeah. And I will never understand that, and I'm going to keep being mad about it, but what I'm really mad about is a bunch of people I really respect were forced to draft a document that articulates a center-right position on healthcare.
Yep.
Any case.
Let's
move on. Oh, one thing I will say, though, they make note of gun violence as a public health issue in this document, which I'm always looking for someone to do.
Yeah.
Because I feel like one way that we can circumvent the gun rights argument about gun violence is to talk about it as a public health issue instead of an issue of freedom.
Yeah.
Because it's not really an issue of freedom, so.
No. Criminal justice. Speaking of guns.
You guys, this was an area where the Sanders picks were, like, not so awesome. Like, I guess they were fine. Sure. But it was, like, a kind of uninspiring list of picks. It was people from, like, the Obama Justice Department. It was, you know, like, Justin Bamberg, who's, like, a state rep from South Carolina. He's on the Our Revolution board. Right. But he's still kind of like, he's not exactly like a real, you know, barn burner on, barn burner is not the right word.
Sure.
Why is Simone Sanders on this?
Yeah, I mean, this, like, look, she's like, I think at this point is now sort of like a credible person. I think that, but as an expert on anything other than talking to you on television,
she's a press person.
Right. She was the Sanders press person in 2016. And like now I think she's like senior advisor or something. But like she's just
to Biden.
She
worked for Biden in this coalition.
Right, so she has no
Principles.
She has no principles and morals. But yeah.
But like, either way, she's not a criminal justice expert. She's a press person.
No, she's not. Yeah, exactly. And she couldn't possibly be a criminal justice expert because prior to working on the Sanders campaign in 2016, she was literally a child.
Right, she was a 26-year-old.
Right,
so,
I mean, the woman is 30.
25-year-old, yeah. So, she hasn't had time to develop expertise in anything other than the thing that she's an expert in, which is a press person thing. She is a press rep.
Right, she talks to you.
And look, she's
on,
really
she
good at that
on,
job.
She's great.
She's a great, if your campaign can attract Simone Sanders to come talk for you on TV, then, like, go ahead and hire her. She's great.
Yeah.
But I don't know why she's on this committee.
I know. But why was anyone?
Why was anyone? Well, yeah, right. Why was anyone on this committee involved?
Yeah.
In any case, the Milquetoast membership aside, the notable thing that they did not do is recommend legalizing marijuana. They recommend decriminalizing it, but like it feels like this is the very least that they could do to address some of the damage that they talk about to Black and Brown communities. That totally. They don't seem to have any policies to address in this document.
And they also, you know, it's just like, I think something like 66% of Americans support that.
Yeah, everyone's
now, finally majority Republican support it also. I mean, it's one of those things where it's like, really? I mean, really?
Why hang on to this?
Well,
this
it doesn't
is one
matter.
Of those things that just makes the Biden people feel like stodgy and old, like they can't keep up.
Because like it wouldn't hurt him at all to do this, and it also
it
like wouldn't hurt
him.
Yeah, it doesn't. Yeah, it's such a head scratcher. And the other big,
but it's like part of this same. There's all these old people in the Senate who like just can't quite come off their opinion that marijuana is like a gateway drug that's going to turn us all into heroin addicts. Like you know, like Dianne Feinstein kind of has this issue too, where like she just can't convincingly say she doesn't think that this, that marijuana is a bad idea.
Right.
And it's like too late. Her whole state, it's legal here.
Right.
Her state's,
it's also too late for her because she's like 117, which I think is, which is Biden's problem also.
Which is Biden's problem also. Yeah. Exactly.
Also missing from here is ending qualified immunity for police officers.
Well, I know exactly why this is not on this document. And I will tell you why. It is because many of the union people that so proudly support Biden are members of unions that support qualified immunity because it protects them personally. There are a lot of responder unions that support Biden. Like when he goes on about his great union support, some of it is real unions that are like progressive unions.
Yeah.
But most of the progressive unions did not endorse Biden in this primary.
Yeah.
Most of the progressive unions endorse Sanders or Warren for reasons that we don't have to explain to you. The kinds of unions that are endorsing Biden are the kinds of unions that maybe have a personal stake in the qualified immunity discussion. And I'm not going to expand on it beyond that.
Yeah.
But Biden has announced that he supports reforming qualified immunity, which
no one knows they what won't that
provide
means.
Any details
he
on.
He doesn't know what that means.
He doesn't. Yeah. Well, he doesn't really know what it is. I wish that he could catch up more quickly on these buzzy issues because he get every time that there's a buzzy issue like this, we're like, look, a lot of us learned what qualified immunity was in the last 2 months.
Sure.
So sorry about it. Like that's life. But once we all knew, we all like knew what we thought of it immediately because we were able to like immediately read how it was dangerous and how it was harming black and brown people and how it was causing what are, some would argue, unnecessary expenses to taxpayers. And how, in general, it's just not, so, like, you don't want a police force that is not beholden to any law.
Yeah.
So I think most of us were able to, like, come up to speed on that, like, pretty quickly.
Right.
And with also, Biden, I think, again and again, he comes out and immediately is just like, no.
I think also most people were able to quickly move past their knee-jerk reaction on what defunding the police was.
Yes.
Also,
something he was not able to do.
You know, because also majority of people in this country now also support the Black Lives Matter movement. And he sort of like still can't, you know, bring himself to even like, you know, utter the word that defund.
Is because of the
what you just said.
Union that is supporting him.
Yeah.
Like the labor movement is not all created equal, you guys.
I know.
There are plenty of unions that are not acting in really upstanding ways all over the place, including the fucking WGA, which walks around telling their members that they don't support Medicare for All, which is something unions who don't support Medicare for All are like my first and most annoying enemies. But so it's not just because he has union support. We don't have to pretend like we think that he's some great justice and peace advocate.
Right.
Is all I'm saying.
Yeah.
In any case, here's what they do call for.
Yes.
Eliminating private prisons, something that both Biden and Sanders were calling for already. Ending cash bail and mandatory minimum sentences.
Yep.
Things we should definitely do that Sanders and Biden were both supporting because they're generally good ideas.
Yep.
They did call for eliminating private prisons entirely, which was a Sanders priority, but not a Biden goal. So that's a Sanders thing that they... I just listed that twice and then I'm... listed that twice and I meant to say important. That was a Sanders
that's a big
it was
one.
Important but I meant to say the first time that it was a Sanders priority and not a Biden priority.
I don't know why
I wrote that. That was a copy paste error and I'm sorry about it and I was reading mindlessly.
Everybody
we're going through a big long list of things. In any case, they call for a federal standard for police departments' use of force, which is what the Democrats have been calling for in their FACO police reform bill that is like the bare minimum that we could do.
Yeah.
And a national database of police officers who commit misconduct. That's also in that police reform bill that the Democrats are voting on or that are promoting. An end to sentences of life without parole for juvenile offenders, which is like, what kind of insane cockamamie people have that in the first place? Every time that I am reminded that that's a thing that can that exists here, I'm just sort of like, why... why is this the government we went with? What kind of idea is this? This is so cruel.
So cruel.
They advocate ending the death penalty,
that,
which
I'm
is also
is
like
in here and thankful.
It's the bare minimum that you can do to be like a civil person. I mean, these days at least. They promise they're going to nominate and confirm judges of federal judges from diverse backgrounds.
Oh sure.
I don't know what that means, but great. I vote for them renominating everyone on every judge panel except for Sotomayor. I've decided that there's only one judge that I like in the entire world and it's Sotomayor. I don't know why. Sure. I just, she's always, she gets it. The rest of the ladies on the Supreme Court don't always get it. I feel like sometimes there are federal judges who have moments of glory, but like, sure. I feel like Sotomayor is the one who is like under the spotlight the most and just like usually gets it.
Just start from the beginning. Start over. Start from scratch.
Yeah, exactly. Start from scratch. Let her be the Chief Justice and everyone else can be new.
Sure.
In any case, they did decide to propose ending the agreement that allows local police departments to enter into agreements with Homeland Security to enforce immigration law, which is another cruel and unusual thing that we do that we shouldn't do. So
sure is.
I guess that's a thing. Like a lot of these criminal justice reforms are things that like any civil society should not have to come out against.
I know.
It's a bad scene over there.
Yeah.
Moving on to the economy.
Right. This was sort of like a fun group of people anyway, mainly because Stephanie Kelton was on it.
Right.
And also somebody from the Buttigieg campaign was on it. So I hope...
Which is always...
I hope she got made to look like a fool at least once during these meetings.
Well, she's a former VP from Goldman Sachs, which you might have guessed from knowing she was on the Buttigieg
campaign. On the Buttigieg. So. Where else did he get all of his stuff?
Right. Exactly. But also, it had Karen Bass as a co-chair. And, you know, people like Karen Bass. Yeah, and Sarah like Nelson, who's the president of the flight attendants
union. Oh, yeah. She's great.
She's great.
Yeah.
They're always up to shenanigans over there. And so, you know, and then it had, like, all of the people you might expect.
Right.
Stephanie Kelton being the standout star exciting person on this panel. But so, listen, did what they proposed come out to be a little bit more expansive and expensive than the Biden campaign's current platform?
Sure. Yeah.
There's a lot of stuff that's meant to address racial inequality and also post-recession policy that's meant to get people back to work. So, like, you know, good on them. There were some interesting proposals in it, including a baby bonds proposal, which Derek Hamilton is one of the Sanders appointees on that committee and is something that he talks about, which is basically that everyone gets a government-funded savings account at birth, which means that kind of...
He's really great. I've heard a lot of interviews with him because he sort of like also sort of like just discusses sort of like the racial bias like in the actual field of economics.
Yes.
Which is really interesting to listen to because you sort of like wouldn't think that like a field that I think a lot of these people consider themselves to be scientists could sort of like have that built into it. But a lot of our economic models like are racially biased from the start.
Well, you might have heard us say on this podcast many times, you might have heard us say that economists are charlatans and economics is not real.
Right.
And I think the reason that we say that is not because we don't believe in what people can glean from the economy, but just that the way that we discuss economics as if it's a science, as if it's infallible, as if the models that economists put forward are sort of definitively true and that human behavior is just logical all the time is bullshit.
Right.
And we know that. And also my grandfather, who was an economist, knew that. And that is why we know that. So we have someone, we got it verified at the source.
Yeah.
But they talk about a big, you know, employment program, big infrastructure development program, a la might say a Green New Deal could be.
Yes, exactly.
Of course, they don't say that, but some might.
Won't call it that, for sure.
Some would say that. So that's something that a lot of these panels echoed. Because even in the healthcare one, they talked about hiring healthcare workers and ensuring that they get paid at least $15 an hour, which to me is like, ensure that they get paid $50 an hour. We're now asking them to like die for the job. Like, $15 an hour is not even like, to me, a sufficient minimum wage anymore, especially in sectors where we're like literally asking people to risk lives to go back to work.
Right.
Education.
Sure.
Now, listen, there are some things about Biden on education that are mediocre but acceptable, thanks to Jill.
Right.
He is the one area where he has someone to give him advice that is not like a horrible human being. Is education.
Yep.
So, and some of these proposals are shifting us away from some bad Obama era policy.
Yes.
One thing that I think is really interesting about Obama education policy is there are a lot of people who come out of the Obama team and are like really staunchly involved or staunchly pro charter school and like very involved in the charter school movement. For sure. And that drives me crazy. That's like a big area of contention. Like I once went to ARENA, which is this Democratic activist conference that a bunch of Obama alums put on. And the one thing, the guy who organizes it got raked over the coals by the attendees at one point because he dared to, you know, they had a bunch of these sort of like hotshot charter school, you know, discussions where these hotshot charter school people come on and tell you about how successful charter schools are. And everyone was just like not having it.
Yeah.
And I think that is something we should be moving away from. And I'm excited. The one thing I'm excited about is that I think that that is something a Biden administration could do. I think the sort of the model that they were working with also really emphasized standardized tests. And so this document really goes on about how we should stop caring so much about just standardized tests and recognize that schools are like providing other services.
Yeah.
And important services. So they promised to scrutinize charter schools and from the federal level in a way that we should already be doing because
totally
charter schools are a bullshit idea.
They also want to get away from like test mania and all these standardized tests.
The standardized test mania they want to get away from. And then they talk about, you know, aid for low-income schools and funding for students with disabilities, things that we shouldn't have to ask for, but
I know.
We do.
But do.
Now,
yeah.
Here's a confusing thing that happened. Annoyingly, even though Biden promised to support universal free tuition at public four-year colleges back when he was unveiling his new and improved education platform, the task force stopped short of that and says that public universities should be free to families earning under $125,000 a year, which is what milquetoast Democrats have been saying for a while now. And I will once again explain we shouldn't means test public education because I shouldn't have to share this with you, but my hatred of Pete Buttigieg requires that.
I was going to say, well, that's how that got back in here, probably.
Exactly. The way that Pete Buttigieg framed this was that we shouldn't pay for the children of billionaires to attend school.
Right. We shouldn't pay for Donald Trump's children to go to a state school, which they would never do because they would obviously go to a private school, you stupid twit. But anyway,
also,
regardless of that,
contend,
I know you have
I'm
a
gonna say
broader
something
point, but
that you don't hear me say often, which is I would contend that we should proudly educate the children of billionaires
for free
at public schools.
We do K-12
in our K-12 system.
Of course.
Because they are also members of society.
Right.
And ostensibly, we are going to, in a just society, ask them to pay higher taxes, a higher tax share, as they should. And as part of that system, they should have access to the same benefits that the rest of us do when it comes to accessing things like education, healthcare. I mean, you know, all of the things that I think should be publicly funded, I think should be available to the very wealthy at the same rates that they're available to everyone else because they should be free.
Yep.
And we should be paying for them with tax dollars. And the wealthy should pay higher taxes because they have more money to pay taxes. You know, if we had a truly progressive taxation system, which we don't, because most of the tax share of poorer people gets taken up by like sales tax.
Maybe they shouldn't get to go to free college because they probably aren't paying their taxes.
Right. They're billion, the 400 richest people certainly aren't. They pay the lowest tax rate of any American, by the way. I just watched a Vox thing about this. But ostensibly, in a just system where we are assuming that public education is an asset that's valuable to all of us, which it is, because it is valuable to everyone that education be available to everyone. It makes our society more functional. We should, of course, be providing free educations to the children of billionaires. We should be taxing them more than what the tuition would be. Because one way in which this becomes a regressive system is that anyone who earns $125,000 a year or over suddenly is subject to a regressive taxation system in which the very wealthy pay a much lower share of their income for that education than people who make $126,000 a year, which in many major cities doesn't even go that far.
Not much.
So, you know, I feel
I couldn't pay
like,
for college right now.
Exactly. That's this talking point is one of the more infuriating ones to me because I think what it actually does is devalue the idea that public services should be for the public. It's like that Hillary Clinton argument I was making where you don't discuss where the line is if the government doesn't have a place in the line. Like, if the government should not be deciding where the line is, you don't ask them to move the line. You tell them there should be no line. In this situation
as well,
I feel like, don't discuss where the line is. Tell them the education should be free and that that's Like, that's where the line is. The line is that the government doesn't get to decide where the line is.
Right. Some of these issues are better served by universality.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so that the fact that the Democrats constantly reiterate this because they want to use the talking point that they're not just giving giveaways to people and people have skin in the game, as Hillary Clinton liked to say, is so insane to me, because what we should really do is value education at every level, the way that we value K-12 education, which is that it should be available to everyone because it is to our benefit to offer educations to people. Society is more functional when people are educated. It means that our workforce can be trained more easily. It means that people have income, there's actual mobility available to people. Like, these are things that you don't know everyone's individual circumstance. So why create a dynamic where people can easily fall through the cracks when you just don't have to?
Yeah.
In any case.
Yep.
Moving on.
Immigration. I think this is our last one.
No, they have a point in the education one about busing. Where they advocate voluntary busing, even though Biden famously opposed federally mandated busing. So apparently he's okay with voluntary busing now, but not mandated busing. Voluntary busing not being a real thing that anyone cares about, because voluntary anything is like a not, like that. It's making busing voluntary is not actually busing.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, do you rich white kid want to go to a school in a poorly funded district? Please get on this bus. Like, that's not a real thing. So, anyway.
Yeah.
Final task force. Immigration.
Yes.
Here's what they didn't offer. Is a call for ICE to be abolished, which is the sort of singular immigration call of the Sanders movement. They want to increase oversight.
Right. They want to put a pin in it for, like, 100 days, I think, while they, like, investigate what they're up to, which I would contend we know. Already.
We know what they're up to. Also, I want to remind us all that ICE didn't exist for... It's not like it's been a part of our government forever.
Yeah, no.
It's a post-9/11 innovation, so it's not like we never existed without ICE. Like, we spent plenty of times out in the world without ICE, without, I don't know, whatever the fear of the far right is, like immigrant criminals running wild or whatever. Like, right. There were times that we had before ICE where nothing happened.
Yeah.
So we could go back to those times is... all I'm saying. People think like that we can't get rid of ICE as if ICE has always been there. That's not true.
Yeah.
ICE has not always been there. In any case, they're going to create an ombudsman and a panel.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah.
They there's no suggestion that unauthorized border crossing should be decriminalized and made a civil offense. This was, you probably remember this discussion happening in most of the presidential debates, at least the early ones that involved Julian Castro, because that was where he was trying to differentiate himself, certainly from Biden, but also from a few of the others.
Everyone, yeah.
So that's disappointing that didn't make it in here, because that was obviously a Sanders
They want to protect the dreamers, which is like the least you can do. Like, don't just protect the dreamers, like... give them a clear path to citizenship.
Right, I was going to say, also they just like, the Supreme Court accidentally just protected them. So, right, like,
so they're protected.
Currently protected this moment. Like
don't just not end the program.
Right.
Like make the program something that
can
apply to more than just 700,000 people who are currently dreamers.
Right.
It would end the Trump travel restrictions to those 13 countries like a racist ploy by the Trump administration to stop Muslim people from traveling here.
That's like another sort of like bare minimum. Like, well, obviously.
Right. Yeah. And they want to end the program that is currently forcing people to wait in Mexico for asylum while their cases work their way through the immigration courts. There are, I think we've forced something like 60,000 migrants to like wait in Mexico while we hear their case.
I want
to
say that the courts also just said that we couldn't do that too recently.
I know. I was going to say, I think that was in the news recently.
It was. Yeah.
They want to increase the number of refugees. We should increase the number of refugees we'll allow to 100% of people who need a place to go, because we're just a country filled with wide open spaces and nothing to do. Currently we allow 18,000 refugees in, and they want to increase it to 125,000. But it feels like in a world where everything is falling apart, the world's loss might be our gain if we were letting refugees come here and then set up their lives here, where we could then benefit from their economic contributions. But whatever. And then they want to end the emergency declaration that they've been using to pay for the wall, which is like
of course
all bare minimum stuff. we should remember that Biden was part of an administration that was deporting people with abandon. So I wouldn't necessarily have expected that this coalition was going to be some of the great forward thinkers on
right.
immigration
also, you
policy.
Might, another thing that you might remember from watching the presidential debates was him being heckled at some of the debates.
That's right. And he was being heckled by Dreamers.
Heckled right. by Dreamers. Yeah, so, exactly.
So, you know, that's a thing to,
yeah.
to think about. Taken together, these are all policies that they could have come up with without pestering Sanders people.
Well, and that, I think, was sort of like the point that I was trying to get to at the beginning yeah. of this, where it was just sort of like they, for so many reasons, like they knew the point at which they would allow themselves to be pushed. So they could have self-pushed. Right? You know? Like, they knew.
They could have practiced self-pushing.
They probably had this 110-page document already printed and handed right. it to their own five members on each of the task force and said
stick
don't,
to the plan.
Don't let them get beyond any of this.
Right.
And then it was just a waste of everybody's time.
Yeah, that's right. I think I would contend that the most radical reading of the documents is the climate change one, and that is because AOC and people from the Sunrise Movement were crafting the language on that. I think it shows that there is value to having some of them in the room, but I think it also shows the limitations of what you can ask of, you know, of even really dedicated progressive people in the face of an administration like Biden's. And one thing I want to say is that people are now, because they're trying to sort of rally around him, keep saying to me, we'll get him in there and then we'll keep pushing. And that is, I want to say that if you are saying that to me, then you are A, someone who's already been pushing with me, or B, you better show up then in January. Because one thing that I think is likely to happen, and one thing that happens every time, is that people who are sort of on the hesitant left, the ambivalent left, use that argument to try to get people on the far left to use what they, you know, the time and energy that they expend on politics, which is always more time and energy in the regular year,
right?
To, you know, to siphon that energy toward, you know, towards the cause that these sort of like status quo, you know, moderates want, and then disappear on us later and explain why nothing is possible. If you are going to tell me in February of 2021, if Joe Biden can even get elected, if you are going to tell me that we can't do any of the things that I want to do because they're all impossible, then I'm probably going to punch you in the face because I'm just going to be so enraged about it, because that argument is so disingenuous.
Yeah.
If you're not going to back it up with anything, and I just know that none of these people are going to back it up with anything. Yeah. I, like everyone, do not want Donald Trump to be the president next year. So the idea that I don't understand the stakes is offensive.
Right.
However, I want to be clear that if you're going to try that with me, then you also better be willing to have the discussion with me once I'm enraged at Biden. You can't just be like, it can't be like under Obama where we were all just like, but he's so fine. He's Obama. It's fine. Yeah. Obama's fine.
Yeah.
It's Obama needed to be pushed, and people didn't show up to push him, people and that's why we didn't get a lot of the things that we should have gotten out of that administration, especially in the 2 years that they had a majority in every chamber.
Yeah.
We have to, and I trust that we have some people now in Congress who will continue to push,
which
we didn't have in those years, so that's great, but we can't just be in there alone. If that's going to be your argument, and you, like us, recognize that this is not actually a compromised position, mm-hmm. then you have to be willing to show up with us later, you know? You won't be, but you have to be.
Well said.
That's the news.
That's it.
On the task forces. We'll be back on Sunday with the news on the news.
The news on the news.
Yeah. And we'll talk to you then.
Yeah.
Bye.
Bye.